Well, we missed Dr. Franz Cronier at BizNews number 7 that was held last week, but my goodness, we'll make sure we don't miss him next year. We'll coordinate our diaries a little better. So much has happened, though, in the last 2 weeks since our last conversation, which has been viewed by more than 300,000 people. 320,000 views last time I looked at it. Time for a catch-up. I was going through it this morning, just trying to see what we had missed in the last 2 weeks, France. And we've had, well, a Cyril Ramaphosa writing an article in Washington in Foreign Affairs. We've had Solidarity and AfriForum being accused of treason for visiting Washington and speaking to congressmen there. The DA rejecting the second budget, Ebram Rasool's outburst, which led to his being ejected from the United States, the proposed renaming of Sandton Drive. And on the positive side, Paul Mashatile says that the ANC did not take money from Iran. That's what he told us at the BizNews conference. But they got the money from from businesses in South Africa, presumably Patrice Motsepe. That there have been very strong arguments at BNC7 about retaining the government of national unity, and that the departure of Rasool opens the door for someone different as the ambassador in the United in Washington, and perhaps opening up the United States. And also that the ANC admits through Mashatile that it's learned a heck of a lot about how to operate in a coalition, and of course the news in the last 24 hours or so that South African troops are now pulling out of the DRC. My goodness, and that's just in 2 weeks. How do you keep up with all of this?
No, you. I mean, if it's what you do, you know, it's always coming in the information and you processing it and making sense of it. I'll add another one to your list. We polled again 200 days into the GNU now, 32% for the ANC. And I don't think we're the only people with a number like that. I think there's a second one. Can't tell you what it is. Also in the 30s. So they're they're having a very hard time.
So, Franz, what are we to make of all of this? Clearly, when it comes at you, all these news headlines, as a South African, you on the one hand getting buffeted and thinking, well, you know, it can't get any worse. And on the other hand, you get these little glimmers of hope that say, it can get better, but behind the scenes, second-level thinking, the kind of stuff that you do, what are you making of all this?
Well, the country is just changing, and it's just changing very quickly. But what causes it to change, I think, is relatively well understood. That in the immediate period after becoming a democracy, South Africa's economy performed relatively strongly relative to what happened today or over the past decade and a bit. We increased the number of people in employment quite sharply. Standards of living were up strongly. All those indicators tell the same story. The ANC did very well in many respects. And as a consequence of that, material circumstances of people were improving. And support for the ANC remained at strong levels and actually increased a little bit while levels of protest action diminished. What's happened in the decade or 15 years leading to today is that the level of fixed investment came off strongly. As a consequence, the country couldn't maintain the growth rates that it had been holding between really, you know, through the 2000 to 2008, job growth stagnated. Think of this. This is an amazing number, Alec. During the era of Mandela and Mbeki, South Africa was creating about 500,000 net new jobs per year. And during the era of Mr. Ramaphosa, that's down to between 50 and 70,000. It's totally collapsed. And South Africa is a free society in the main. You can do what you like. You're not necessarily charged with treason, to use a contemporary example, for being critical of the government. And as a consequence of that, and the fact that we hold open and free elections, when people's material circumstances, the lives they live, do not improve, they begin to look for political alternatives. And that's still all that's going on at the moment. And the ANC got hammered last year, 40%. It has subsequently done absolutely nothing to address the core reason for the collapse in its support, which is that South Africa's levels of fixed investment are too low to create the economic growth, to create the jobs for the ANC to recover. Fixed investment levels are something you measure as a share of the size of the economy. And South Africa's number sits at about 15% at the moment. And that's perfectly consistent with the economy growing at 1% or 1 and a bit. In order for the economy to grow at levels of 4 or 5%, and that's important because at that rate, we would reduce our unemployment rate to 10% over the next 20 years. We need to lift levels of fixed investment by 10 percentage points at least, from the current 15% to 25%. If you wish to survive or thrive politically as a South African government, that should be your single objective. And if you achieve it, you will be very politically successful. You'll command a stable governing administration. But there has been no effort in that direction since the ANC's defeat, and as a consequence, its support continues to slide. More dramatic than that, even, is in these recent numbers, we tested what would happen if there was an election without Mr. Ramaphosa. So he's not an option. He's not. Don't factor him into your thinking as ANC leader. Now, a result like that, it gives you an indication of direction. Don't worry about the precise number because it must still happen. And how it happens will determine how people respond to it and who his successor is and all of that. But with that, ANC support went into the 20s. So this is a party that's in very serious, real serious trouble. But not even the experience of last year's election defeat appears to have been able to inspire the actions to close the fixed investment gap from 15 to 25% to get the growth rate back to 4 or 5. Well, what rate do emerging markets grow at around the world? The average growth rates of around 4%. South Africa, the last 15 years, 1%. Why? Fixed investment here is 15%. Emerging markets is 25% plus. Hello.
Ideology is trumping practicalities. That's the message that we're getting time and time again. Why does the ANC not abandon this ideology that is taking it further and further down and just see for itself what needs to be done? And surely it's not that difficult to have that mindset shift.
It's funny, for all that I'd spend my day doing this, I don't really know why the ANC allows itself to continue losing support. Because it's so easy and obvious to see what to do to reverse that. I recently had the opportunity to talk to a little ANC group on where to go. And a point I made to them is the voters that have left you in making the decision to vote for someone else were desperately unhappy that they had to make that decision. They really wanted to vote for you. It was their greatest desire. It would have made them happy. But the state of the economy and hence their material circumstances were such that they felt they had no choice but to take this decision. I think the ideology plays a role in it. Well, it has to some extent. You certainly see that in some of the decisions that are taken. I think a second thing that we must factor in much more strongly and why does the ANC not turn is its structure as an organization. It has a very large board, the executive committee, perhaps with all its hangers-on. It's 80 members, but with the hangers-on, you're getting to about 100 people. And led by Mr. Ramaphosa, who wishes to find consensus. Now, anyone watching this show who's had any experience of running an organization, not just one in trouble, would know that if you need to bring in 100 people from every different background and try and get them to find consensus before you move ahead, you're not going to get there. So it doesn't have an executive. The leader of the ANC and of the country has executive powers, but the case of Mr. Ramaphosa is reluctant to use those. So there's ideology, there's the structure of the thing. And then I think there's the great problem of corruption that the ANC has become inside itself a means to extract cash from whatever venture your ANC, a role, but however senior that is, offers you access to. So at the lowest level, you might be a sort of branch level person, chairman or something. And in the municipality, you're able to employ that to sort of swing a tender some way or another. Once you, as you move up the ranks, the opportunities are greater. And the exposure to cash and that the power that wields. And remember, once you've done that, you're stuck. Your colleagues might be aware of some of the things you were party to. So it becomes very difficult to challenge one of your peers to say, well, look, this chap's idea is absolutely hopeless. We have to turf him out, or he's completely ineffective. Because he might come back at you and say, well, you know, we didn't appreciate that. And by the way, we know where your skeletons are buried. So I think it's across all three factors. Ideology, to an extent, sometimes it manifests as that. This, just the management structure is off. And then there's this Mexican standoff within the ANC as well. But even for those reasons, I still find it absolutely amazing to think, when you look at the data, how easy it would be for the ANC to be back at 50, 60% governing the country stably on its own terms, and that the decisions that it takes, almost without exception, appear to be almost engineered to ensure its eventual political destruction.
Is there anything that we can take, any hope we can take out of this? The way you've unpacked it now appears that there is only one future for the ANC, and that's no future. So what emerges out of these?
I wouldn't say there's only one, because it is so easy, even at this late stage, to turn it around. Elementary. You could turn it around. So I don't think it's necessary. It has to go this way, but this is the way that it's going. South Africa is a fundamentally free and open society. This distinguishes us from many other post-colonial emerging markets, for when they got into trouble politically, the first post-colonial administration, it sought to use violence and related means, terror, to stay in power. Now, we haven't seen much evidence of that here, so we find ourselves in the fortunate minority of such societies. Point number one. Point number two is that where the state fails in South Africa, it permits private actors to start to fill the gap. And that mustn't be taken for granted. If South Africa was a fascist dictatorship society or one moving towards that, the state might have forbidden you from putting those solar panels on your roof because you'd be threatening Eskom's monopoly and undermining national security as a consequence. Here there's even now and again attempts at incentives to allow people to do that. We've seen very interesting data on how the extent of blackouts during a period of time is perfectly inversely proportional to the extent to which private rooftop solar installations are installed in SA. In terms of security measures, you know, the definition of a state is a monopoly on the use of violence, and the South African state's not good at the security of anything. But the private security sector, boots on the ground, private officers, now three times the size of the police and the army combined, and with skills way beyond anything that's commanded by the police or the army. Sometimes the government kind of growls at that and sort of threatens it, but it's now past the point of no return. So, well, number one, it's a totally free society. You can do whatever you want. Number two is where the state retreats, collapse isn't necessary because private action can mitigate the damage. Can't completely reverse the damage, but it mitigates it. The third thing to say is that we're in a very different era to what might have been the case 30 or 40 years ago for a volatile emerging market like South Africa to go through a difficult political phase. People might have had to leave with their money. We have an alternative here. And that is that people who do have some money are able to send that abroad. They can, for example, go into the dollar. And they don't have to go with their money. They can stay in the country and establish what are enclaves, or what a sort of friend of mine has called citadels, that many South Africans live in. And these come in different forms. They're these purpose-built villages that the wall around, and there's even one I'm aware of with a moat around it. And there you can be born and die within the walls and never see the country outside. To some extent, the Western Cape becomes an enclave of sorts. You just drive across the border and you immediately feel the difference. Then within that, you might have these citadels, and then you have other communities like Hermanus that you now know so well. You take over the town once a year. And that becomes a citadel of sorts. So South Africa retains its middle-class skills base to a far greater extent than would have been the case for comparable countries 30 or 40 years ago. And because of that, through a period of extreme political hardship, I mean, we've had volatility, we haven't yet had hardship, South Africa will retain many of the skills it needs to rebuild the country in a future era. And that's a great advantage, because if you were, let's say, Zimbabwe, and you got a better government and you wish to rebuild, you have to bring in the diaspora from around the world, which is very hard to do. We'll retain those skills within the country, and therefore a significant share of the tax base is retained within the country. And the final thing I'll tell you that remains true, and you know it if you chair a polling organization, is that public opinion remains very moderate, very centrist, and very pragmatic. We are not a radicalized society. The sense created of South Africa in its mainstream media and on social media of deeply, pathologically divided along lines of race and culture and history is not true of the country, even at this stage. And that's amazing, given the extent of unemployment amongst younger people. You'd have think it would have radicalized to a significant extent by now. And that it hasn't shows just what a well of common goodwill and decency exists among South Africans. And if you add those factors together, I did this recently for a bank. On macro South Africa data, the growth rate sucks, debt and deficits broken through the covenant levels, and well, this budget we haven't yet had, but I'm sure will at some point. The crime data is bad, the investment data is appalling, the unemployment data is frightening. However, and that's all true, and you mustn't shy away from that or try and downplay it, because it causes such immense suffering for so many millions of people. You must actually upplay it. However, for all of that, the free society is one in which private sector can take up the space to an extent left by the retreating state, in which these enclaves exist, and you can send your money abroad, and therefore you don't have to go with it, and where public opinion is very sound, very centrist, and very moderate. On those four points, it's very difficult, actually, to say where does South Africa end, 10, 15 years from now. It might very easily, should the ANC collapse entirely, which it seems intent on ensuring it does, it might very easily elect democratically a centrist administration that could quite easily start the process of rebuilding South Africa, and the country comes out on the flip side as into the 2040s as a successful emerging market democracy.
As of right now, we've been told, and at BNC7 we certainly were told, that we have a very dangerous period to navigate. The DA appears intent on pushing its resistance to the budget and indeed to the VAT hike. There were a number of people saying, don't do that, don't push it too far, because we desperately need this government of national unity. If you were advising both sides, what would you suggest?
Well, no, you don't need the government of national unity at all costs. There's no point in having a government of national unity that essentially maintains the policies it inherited and the rate of economic growth. You can't be a 1% growth country with a 30% youth unemployment rate and think that by sitting tight, it's all going to be okay. I assure you, it will not be okay in the fullness of time. And in the fullness of time, probably sooner than people realize, the reasons that caused ANC support to collapse, the inability to meet the material circumstances, expectations of people, that will attach the GNU and it will pull the GNU down as well. And when you pull the GNU down, you don't know what you get in the aftermath. You could get something radical and populist. So it's absolutely wrong to say the you stand on the GNU at all costs because otherwise we'd have doomsday, whatever that was. No, you don't do that. The GNU has to be a catalyst for reform. And I think the DA and John Steenhuisen specifically did very well during those talks. We spoke about that at the time to get, and I think a great, and the ANC people as well, getting South Africa to the GNU at that moment was a great achievement, and we should be grateful to everyone involved. I am somewhat critical of the DA in the immediate aftermath. I think they went along too easily with ideas that would checkmate the country's economy. It couldn't possibly grow. One of those is the Bella legislation, and my problem with Bella has absolutely nothing to do with Afrikaans. I think that's complete red herring. The problem with Bella is it reversed gains that South Africa made under its Schools Act in, I think, 1996, that gave parents far greater authority over education. And if a parent is control over the school their kid's in, the output of that school, the performance is much better than where the school is run by a bureaucrat. And Bella's reversed that, and that puts paid to our prospects of improving the quality of our matric class. And this is already a matric class where 500 kids are going to pass maths with a grade of 50% or higher. I'm very critical of some of what the DA has been doing on climate. It championed a new climate act yesterday. South Africa cannot afford to stigmatize carbon, because carbon-based energy is the only route we have to, over the next 20 years, produce enough electricity to make possible an industrial-based, to an extent, industrial-based economic recovery, which we need to mop up the legions of the unemployed. And we do that by refitting the coal fleet. So I think the DA got that one wrong as well, and a few other things too. But they were in a difficult space. Of late, since the budget, I think the DA has played things very well. They're in a strong position. You know, ANC voters disapprove or oppose tax increases by a margin of 2-3 to 1. So what the ANC has done to get itself in a position where it's clinging to what we call a VAT baby, and fighting the DA to the point of threatening the survival of the GNU, which is very popular still with the public, the GNU, because they also fear this doomsday kind of idea. How it's positioned itself like that is one of these, I said, I don't know. I don't know how you get into a position where you're at 40% of the vote, and at your next budget, you champion increasing taxes on the poor, and then you fight that to the very death. It's unbelievable, nonetheless. The DA has found exactly the right issue upon which to challenge the ANC here, and not just on the question of taxes, on the tax merits alone. Alex, South Africa's expenditure, government expenditure as a share of the size of the economy number, so government expenditure to GDP, is 34%, 33%. We reckon that the point of diminishing returns, where revenue is so high that you're extracting expenditure so high that the state is pulling so much out of the economy to drive its projects, that you're actually shrinking or depressing the growth potential of the economy, was at about 25%. So there's, you know, 7-8 percentage points past the point of diminishing returns, still trying to increase taxes. So you can make a tax argument on this, but more important for the DA is it's resetting the balance of power inside the GNU here and the terms of reference, that it actually is a coalition between two parties in the map. So it's also a GNU, but it's actually a coalition between two parties. And if the DA does not manage to establish such a new balance of power, then there is no prospect that the GNU could introduce the kinds of reforms to improve South Africa's economic performance by raising, again, the one thing, fixed investment to GDP. And I think they've thus far played this thing pretty well. They have sympathy in the ANC, I assure you of that. There are people who have made calls to senior ANC leaders and said, what are you doing on this VAT increase? There are so many other means to get to the same position, and to threaten the GNU is not in your best interests at all. So no, to answer your question, it took 10 minutes. The GNU at all costs is a disastrous strategy. You back the GNU because it drives reforms. If it's unable to do that, then the GNU must break up again. It probably will in time. And then we can perhaps get into that. Then there are alternative means open to push for reform, but fatal to accept policies that allow 1% growth rate when your unemployment rate is 30%. It's just very dangerous. Don't think like that, Alec.
So this is the hill on which the DA should sacrifice the GNU if it is to be sacrificed.
Doesn't have to sacrifice the GNU. It's got many options. I think something that's quite pleasing is I sometimes had the sense, maybe I was well informed, that the DA was kind of felt that it was a guest inside the government. You know, the government was the ANC's house and the DA was a guest. And if the GNU didn't work out, then the DA could kind of leave the government again. Not the right way to think about it. The government couldn't survive. We'll talk on the maths now. Easily survive without the DA's presence. And it also has options. And one of those options is to call a vote of no confidence in Mr. Ramaphosa. Now that it would take extreme provocation to get there. But it would have the power to do that. And a vote of no confidence in Mr. Ramaphosa in Parliament would succeed. He would lose, and it would be the end of his political career. And the consequences of that, given his importance to ANC support, would be to do great damage to the prospects of that party. And in the aftermath, it was perfectly possible to build a new coalition government, perhaps with a new ANC leadership, if it was able within 30 days to find someone that could put up as a presidential candidate, or even at the right point that the country is pushed to new elections. So the change, the point is country's changing very quickly. It's changing quickly because the government cannot meet the expectations of people for their standards of living, because it can't draw the right amounts of fixed investment, because its policies are hostile to invest. The GNU is not the end point of that process. It's a potential catalyst to accelerate South Africa to a point where it has a reform-oriented government. And if that means that the GNU at times must break up and reconstitute itself differently, or perhaps trigger new elections, then that's part of the process that we have to move through to get to change. Obviously, there are risks involved in that at the same time. But there is no alternative to get to broad reform. Should you be stuck in a situation, that question might arise. Well, what if the GNU is kind of hopeless and it kind of keeps finding itself, its way back to itself, and it's ANC and the DA, no one pushes for reforms, the economy just grows at 1% if we're lucky. Then what we'll see for a period is an accelerated process of this enclave formation where life for poorer South Africans will get a lot worse. And life for the established middle classes will, a degree of normality will be preserved in these enclaves and the citadels within the border enclaves that we've spoken about already.
But given all the maths and given the way that you've sketched it, it does look like this is a period of make or break, certainly in the short term.
Let's pause on the maths quickly. It's really interesting. GNU has 287 seats in Parliament. The DA has 87 of those. So without the DA, you've got 200. But it's unlikely, under its new leader, that the Freedom Front hangs around in the GNU without the DA. So now you've got 194. Bring back ASA and Herman Mashaba, you get to 200, and bring in one or two of the smaller actors like Bosa or so, and you get to 201, 202. So conceivably, the ANC can build an alternative GNU without the DA. But But that GNU is hardly going to drive any reforms. Its credibility is going to be shot. Its popularity with the public and the partners to it, their popularity will collapse. The DA looks stronger going into the next election. And even at 202, to get something through parliament that requires a 201 plus majority, the ANC would have to have all its members in the House, which it doesn't always have. That's a perennial problem within the ANC. Another alternative the ANC has, just on the maths, is, okay, the DA walks or goes or gets turfed out or whatever happens, and the Freedom Front goes. The ANC and what's left of its partners have 190-something votes. And then they just try and piecemeal, a kind of nickel and dime, everything that comes before parliament that needs a majority and try to strike a sort of piecemeal deal on this question or that question of legislation, much like they've tried to do a bit on the budget now, but they tend to have found that they've run into a few dead ends trying to do that. And so they continue as a minority government. But again, no reform is triggered. ANC credibility continues to slip, and that march into the 30s continues. So a way to think about the politics in that case is the ANC is assaulting the 30% is over here. ANC is assaulting the 30% level from the top, and the DA is assaulting the 30% level from the bottom. And there's kind of a race to see who can get closest to 30% first. And even if the ANC created an alternate GNU without the DA, even if it tried to proceed as a minority government and it escaped the vote of no confidence consequence that might attach to that, in the greater scheme of things, South African economic growth, outlook, internal stability, reform prognosis would be pretty much the same as what we had seen in the GNU up to the point where the DA grabbed hold of the VAT question and said, actually, this isn't good enough. And the thinking behind that in the DA is very sharp, very shrewd so far. Last point, while I'm at it, it's not just hostile to the ANC, because the ANC people who are appalled at what's going on, Alec, have their heads in their hands when they think about why their party is fighting for a tax increase. At the moment, of all the things to fight on, this, terrible. And as the DA takes a harder line, particularly given that the ANC is not led by a particularly strong person, that does encourage pragmatists within the ANC ranks to say, you know, this is perhaps something that we could work with towards reform more easily than we were able to do with Mr. Ramaphosa, the balance of whose time in office he has had an absolute majority and done absolutely nothing to take policy steps to raise the level of fixed investment. Alec.
So two things to end off with. On the one part, Helen Ziller did say coalition start now. The way she addressed the Bella Bill and the NHI and the EWC was to say that was from the previous parliament. And so it was on the table anyway, and they'll fight it in different ways, extra parliamentary, perhaps in court. But she said now this is where coalitions begin. Do you agree with that? And the second thing is, what about the international picture? We haven't even touched on that yet. You have a potentially very strong partner in Washington if you play your cards right as South Africans, but we're just playing all the twos at the moment.
Yeah, I think there's merit to what Helen says, that you know, the GNU starts now because the early days, they did well in the negotiations, I thought. Afterwards, I don't think they were amazing, the DA and the GNU, nor was the ANC, just carrying on with what had brought it to its knees to begin with. And now this VAT thing potentially resets it. Yeah, that's probably right. On the international picture, well, it's exactly what we've been talking about. Why is the ANC holding a VAT baby in its arms? Why is it fighting with the United States, which U.S. fixed investment levels in Africa have been lagging behind those of China for a decade? And the implications of that for the Americans could be quite serious. There's some really interesting data out last week that China is central to about a third of all the port developments going on in Africa at the moment. Africa's got 50 votes on UN fora. The data network, Africa's got more cities of 1 million inhabitants than Europe and America combined. And economies growing faster than the developed outside of South Africa. We're the laggard of the continent. Growing very quickly. This is somewhere where you wish to be present. When ISIS was displaced from the Middle East, terrorism takes root in Africa. The terror threat indices scores, which measure the extent to which a country has a terror presence and threat, for many African countries are now higher than the old Middle Eastern staples. So the U.S. does have an interest. I was reprimanded in Washington on my last visit for telling Americans what their interests in Africa are, but that, so I do that advisedly by friends, by incidentally, who said, you don't come here and tell us why we need you, which really is to show how the culture there has changed. Mm. The America is behind the curve on fixed investment. If it wants to catch up to China continent-wide on fixed investment, let's say over the next decade, the quantum of dollars it would need to invest, this is amazing, and let's say we could convince it to focus those on us over here, would be sufficient to close our fixed investment gap to 25%. And we'd be growing at 4%, and we'd be fine, the ANC would be back at 60%, most likely. Now, why, Alec, are we fighting? Where will the capital come from to close the fixed investment gap? At 20 to 1, the dollar can do it. But our foreign policy is to, this wasn't the ambassador off on some gambit of his own. You saw that in Mr. Ramaphosa's letter in Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy or whatever it was, and his backing of South Africa's formation of the Hague Group. The presidency and foreign affairs here had positioned itself in the Trump administration to be the spear point of an effort to take on the United States and bring it down. It is mad. It is not in our best interest. It's got nothing to do with the South African national interest. And it's but madness seems to be the theme of the season. We're gonna fight the great Satan in the US, and we're gonna increase taxes at home. And on the back of that, the ANC is going to get back its political majority. What an extraordinary kind of time, with thing just to watch happen. I find it amazing.
Is it possible, and some very smart guy suggested this to me the other day, that our foreign affairs has been captured by Muslim interests? I was looking at the numbers today. 1.6% of South Africa's population, according to the 2022 census, are Islam. 85.3% are Christian. And it seems really strange for a overwhelmingly Christian country to be taking on the interests of a tiny, tiny minority. And then I had a look through it and thought, but hang on, our foreign affairs minister was a converted Muslim. Her husband, who's quite a firebrand, is the director general, and. So is it possible that that's why we're doing all these crazy things and that foreign affairs has been captured?
I've read some very compelling analyses of that. What I would say, we being optimistic, which you can be, if I thought the country shot to pieces is going to collapse, I'd tell you that. But I think the circle that is driving this mad policy towards the United States is very small inside the ANC and inside the government as well. And I think it's a suitable sample that there are a very broad range of people who agree completely, political people, with this sense in trying to form a constructive relationship with the United States, and India. And when we talk about this, I say India. Look at India. India is a BRICS country, a prominent one, influential one, maintains excellent relations with Russia and China. But no one's issuing executive orders or kicking out its ambassador, because that's not the demand from the US. Not that you break ties with China or Russia, not that you entirely pick sides, but you stop taking actions that threaten US national security. And then there are common strategic interests. I've spoken about the ones in Africa on previous shows. I'm going to go through it all again. I've spoken about the strategic importance of the South Atlantic and of Simonstown being one of three points that anchors control of the Indo-Pacific. South Africa could very easily build an extremely constructive relationship with the Trump administration. And here's the South African mainstream media is so nasty about Mr. Trump and so snide about him and doesn't miss an opportunity to blame American taxpayers for the suffering of AIDS patients in South Africa. But you can think about the situation differently, that the US does have strategic interests to look after. And the ANC does have an interest in getting back to power. If it doesn't, we'll find our way through future coalitions. And those interests, even those interests, the interests of the people in Luthuli House and the interests of the Trump administration itself are not as misaligned as mainstream media reporting gets people to think. And it might be a matter as simple as just changing how some serious people, senior influential people in and around South Africa and America think about the problem of their relationship. Because this adversarial stuff is not in the U.S.'s best interest, my good friends there and notwithstanding. And for South Africa to close the fixed investment gap, if we're not going to do that through better ties with the United States, I'm waiting for someone to tell me who commits the 10 percentage points of GDP in fixed investment that's going to close the country's fixed investment gap. And there isn't an answer to that question.
Dr. Frans Grenier is the chairman of the board at the Social Research Foundation, and he's a political and economic analyst. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.